Hi everyone, Benjamin here. You're listening to a special edition of Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. How do scientists study the most dangerous pathogens on the planet? Viruses like Ebola, Nipah, Rift Valley fever, these can cause terrible symptoms and sometimes even death in humans and animals, and there's always the threat that they'll spread very quickly across the globe. If we're going to develop life-saving diagnostics and vaccines to prevent outbreaks of these diseases, we need to understand how they infect their hosts and how they cause the symptoms they do. Doing this requires a very special kind of laboratory. Only a handful of these exist in the world that are capable of working on these microbes. These high containment facilities are specially equipped with the most stringent safety and security features, fail-safes and backups. One of these laboratories is found in Boston in the United States. It's called The Needle, the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories. I recently had the pleasure of traveling to Boston to visit The Needle and to take a look around inside. I was very lucky to be allowed access to the facility, to meet some of the people working there, and to find out what happens behind the scenes. My visit began very early on a sunny Sunday morning outside my hotel in Boston.
Paul, good morning. How are you doing?
Morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Right, give me 2 seconds to get in.
Okay.
This is my old pal, Paul Dupre.
So basically all of this bit, any bit of Boston, which is gridded and flat.
Aside from being an excellent guide to the history of Boston's Back Bay area, he's also a professor of microbiology at Boston University, and he works in The Needle. As Paul explained to me, The Needle is set up to work on a full spectrum of microbes, from relatively easy to handle pathogens through to extremely dangerous ones. At this point, I think it's worth talking about the different levels of biosafety that exist in microbiology. Now, biosafety levels range from BSL-1 at the very lowest level, all the way up to BSL-4 at the highest. People working in BSL-4 labs are required to wear the full kind of spacesuit business, the kind that you might see in a Hollywood movie.
And then we have to up the level of containment, and what we absolutely have to do to work with the most deadly viruses on the planet.
As we pulled up to the building, my first thoughts of The Needle were that it looked solid. So as you might imagine, security here is fairly tight, so I'm about to go into the gatehouse here. I think they're going to scan all of my stuff and make sure that I am who I say I am and that I'm not up to no good. I'll see you on the other side. Everyone who works at The Needle has to go through an eye recognition scanner to gain access to the building, which is delightfully futuristic.
So then that gets me in.
Hello.
Are you
right? I'm very well. How are you doing today? I'm going to take this off and put this in here, if that's okay.
Everything we had with us had to go through a scanner as well, including my recorder and my microphone.
So what else can we do about it here? Metal detector. The main thing here is really weapons.
Yeah.
That's what they're pretty much looking for.
So it's just like a modern airport kind of security.
It's basically like an airport security, yep. And you just get into the habit of it, then it becomes completely normal. You just come to work, you do your eyes, the door opens, you do your bag, you know the guys day on day, and it's nice to chat with these people on the way in. And then you go to work.
The first person I was introduced to was the director of The Needle and professor of microbiology, Ron Corley.
Ron, how do you do? Ben. Nice to meet you after all of our chat this week.
The Needle is one of a network of laboratories whose function is to do emerging infectious disease research. Our missions are to do innovative research on emerging pathogens and pathogenesis and to train the next generation of scientists.
And why do we need to look at emerging infectious diseases?
Well, as I'm sure you know, emerging infections appear every 12 to 18 months, and they require different levels of containment from biosafety level 2 through biosafety level 4 in order to be able to study them safely. So our job is to be able to study these pathogens no matter what their containment level.
So what sort of things are we talking about? Are we talking about human and animal diseases or mainly one or the other?
Well, when you're talking about human diseases now, you're also talking about animals. So this is a One Health world. And we do not understand the nature of reservoirs and how animals have evolved to be reservoirs for many pathogens. So understanding that process and understanding the jump and what the disease is like in humans is absolutely critical to our understanding.
So could you maybe give me a sense of the sort of things that are being looked at, maybe from the top to the bottom, if that's maybe the right way of putting it?
From the higher level, we will be studying pathogens such as Ebola, Marburg, Lassa. All of those pathogens have animal reservoirs, even though Ebola is not clear what its animal reservoir is yet. We also will be looking at diseases, a variety of viral diseases that are transmitted by vectors like West Nile virus. We currently have a program in Zika, which is of great importance to the world. It's one of the most recent pandemics. And we will be studying and currently are studying tuberculosis, which is still the most successful human pathogen in the world.
Well, let's maybe, you know, take a bit of a sidestep and talk about the building itself then in your role as director. So, I mean, I'm looking out the window here now. It seems to be, it takes up most of a city block, I would say, the grounds, give or take.
Yeah, it sits on the medical campus. We sit in the middle of the south end of Boston, which is a beautiful, beautiful area of the city. Very diverse neighborhoods. And we look out over the financial district of the city. We look out over Copley, so the views couldn't be better. The building itself is 40% infrastructure. So you look at this building, it's a seven-story building, but only four of the floors actually have laboratories and offices on them. The rest are infrastructure floors.
Well, on that then, say looking out the window here, I can see, you know, people's houses, you know, across the street pretty much here. So, I mean, let's go back to when this was essentially just, you know, a vacant lot or whatever it was at the time. How did you go about getting it built in a built-up area?
There was a very long process of consultation with the city. We now have had the only comprehensive risk assessment done on a biological facility in the world, to my knowledge. That risk assessment took 4.5 years in order to get it completed. We've successfully made it through there, so we are now in the process of permitting the Biosafety Level 4 laboratories.
The Needle's Biosafety Level 4 labs are almost fully up and running, but they're not quite open yet. Paul Jabre told me that they have the capacity to begin working on Ebola tomorrow, but at the moment, they're just waiting for the final green light and government go-ahead to start working on BSL-4 level pathogens. So you're three quarters of the way there to being fully operational.
Three quarters of the way, but the last quarter seems to be taken all the time because that's the unique aspect of it. And people know biosafety level 4 pathogens from science fiction more than they do from science. The reality is it is the safest way to study a pathogen. And many people who work at biosafety level 4 would far rather work there than in biosafety level 2.
Why is that?
Because in biosafety level 4, you are in a fully encapsulated suit. You have special environmental and laboratory facilities that protect you and the people outside of the lab. So it ends up being the safest place to work. Plus, the best scientists, the most trained, are there.
Getting this message across to people that live next door to the Needle isn't easy. As Ron tells me, it's all about being honest and having an open dialogue with the community.
We as scientists have not done a good job of communicating with the public. What is the importance of science? Why is it important? How do you do it safely and securely? How do you protect not only the people doing the work, but the communities around them? And so one of the commitments that we have in this building is to be completely transparent with the community, to tell them what goes on in here, to share that with them. We have a community liaison committee whose responsibility it is to advise us on community concerns, but also share what we do with the community. I think that's critical to our success. And without it, we will always be untrusted. So building trust is important, and putting a face out into the community is necessary to do that.
So let's think about the building itself and maybe the built environment. I'm guessing the walls here are quite thick. I've seen a lot of fences and all the rest of it. I mean, talk me through some of the aspects of the building that make it what it is.
Yeah. Well, the building was built after the Oklahoma City bombing in the United States. As a result, buildings that need to be safe or buildings that are built with federal funds have to be built to embassy standards. So we have a 150-foot setback to the fence line. It's not simply because pathogens only go 150 feet. It looks imposing to the neighborhood, and I think that's part of the reason that the neighbors got worried about it. It doesn't look like any other academic building. We have security here 24/7. You have to go through checkpoints, biometric and proximity checkpoints throughout your entry into the building. That way people are regulated as to what floors they can get to and what floors they cannot. So it looks very different from most other academic facilities, but in the end, it's just a laboratory. It's just a sophisticated lab, but it is a laboratory.
As you'd imagine, a lab as advanced as this one has a load of special architecture to keep it safe and secure. The lengths that they had to go to while constructing the building were really rather extraordinary, as Ron explains.
If you look at the building, I mean, the building is designed so that it is structurally very different from other buildings. Of course, the biosafety level 4 has to be a separate building. The reason is that to decontaminate those facilities, you must fill them with essentially poisonous gas, vaporized hydrogen peroxide or vaporized formaldehyde, and you don't want that leaking into the hallways. And so the rooms have to be able to be fully sealed without any crevices. So the walls of those spaces are 12 inches thick of heavily reinforced concrete, ballistic glass, which doesn't leak. So when you look at those spaces, they are very different from the rest of the spaces.
So it's almost as if there's a building within a building, maybe?
There is a building within a building, and there is a spacer between the two buildings. The reason being, Boston, believe it or not, is considered an earthquake-sensitive zone. And so if we had an earthquake, you'd want the two buildings to resonate at different frequencies so that they wouldn't bump into each other.
Now, I looked into this. New England does indeed have earthquakes. Most of them are very small, but there have been some big ones in the past, like the 1755 Cape Ann earthquake, which was off the coast of Massachusetts. The designers that planned and built the Needle really had to think of every possible eventuality. I wanted to see some of this architecture for myself, so later that day, I met up again with Paul Dupre, who showed me around some of the labs. Paul, where are we right now then?
So this is just a standard biosafety level 2 laboratory. You can work with pathogens here which are able to be vaccinated, people are able to be vaccinated against. So if we have a vaccine, you can vaccinate the person who's working or the person may have already had the disease, and they can work with those pathogens at biosafety level 2. So the best example, whatever you think about good vaccines that we have, MMR, measles, mumps, rubella. There's a great measles vaccine, there's a great mumps vaccine, there's a great rubella vaccine. They're all combined into this trivalent vaccine. We use that to protect against this disease. We've eliminated this disease from the developed world, and that's a BSL2 pathogen.
As we move further into the building, Paul explains to me the importance of controlling the air pressure within the Needle. The deeper you get inside the building, moving from BSL2 all the way through to BSL4, the lower the air pressure gets. Now, air naturally flows from high to low pressure. I guess you could think of it like being on the top of a multi-story car park, rolling a tennis ball down the ramps. The ball always travels down and not up. And that's what's happening to the air inside the Needle. And it means that the air and microbes are always being sucked into the building rather than blown out. The Needle facility is full of actual needles, in this case, small gauges that measure the air pressure in the different parts of the building.
It's all about pressure. You will see that the pressure gets lower and lower and lower as we go through these different suites. And the reason why this little needle is there is because I can look at the needle and very, very quickly know that the pressure is correct, that the facility is operating as it is intended to be. So it gives me this nice little visual gauge for what's going on.
Thank you. You have been identified.
The different biosafety levels in the building are separated by iris scanners and airlocks to ensure that nothing infected can leave the lab.
Okay, so what sort of things are we working on then in this lab?
So this would be a laboratory where you would work with viruses like MERS and SARS, these new coronaviruses, West Nile virus, dengue virus if you're in the UK, but not dengue virus if you are in the US, and just a wide range of pathogens which are not as deadly as Ebola virus and Nipah virus, which can be treated in the hospital by care whenever someone gets unwell, but there's no licensed vaccine or good therapeutic that might allow you to routinely vaccinate the population.
Working in these labs also requires scientists to wear more than just a basic lab coat. Paul began showing me the kind of boiler suit that researchers would have to put on before entering the lab. Here again, just like with the building as a whole, it's all about controlling air.
And then this is the battery that goes in here, and this provides me the air if I was working in BSL-3.
It kind of looks like a giant gas mask in a strange way, but it seems to be like in a holster. So this presumably is something that I strap around my waist then, and this is pulling clean air in for my mask. Is that right?
Yeah, so if I'm going to put this crinkly, difficult mask over my head, I need to make sure that I can breathe. Where does the air come from? Well, it comes from this funny little piece of equipment here, which basically provides the air that whenever I connect it to this tube, it blows air into the mask and keeps me at a higher positive pressure to the rest of the facility, which means all of the viruses that I'm working with are always blown away from me. A really good example of a BSL-3 pathogen is influenza. You can imagine if you were working with influenza, and you know how you get influenza through the air, it's a respiratory virus. This is the sort of respiratory personal protective equipment that would protect you whenever you work with influenza. And all of that protective equipment has been designed, has evolved over years and years and years. You can imagine, this is pretty disposable looking. That's not how this started off. They were big, they were bulky, they were cumbersome. And then it's been miniaturized, and we've got these very, very nice little packs with these rechargeable batteries that you see here, which just allow us to blow the air and keep the operator safe. Because ultimately, as much as the scientist loves the work, they want to be safe. I have a responsibility to my staff to keep them safe whenever they do the work. I also want to be safe whenever I do the work, which is why personal protective equipment is so important.
Once you've suited up, you can enter the lab itself. Paul showed me a really fancy piece of kit that you wouldn't find in many research facilities. A confocal microscope enclosed in a big transparent cube.
So what this is a confocal microscope. It allows us to look in three dimensions, in tissues and cells, and we can really, really drill down very, very deeply and look at the spatial, the localization of where the virus is in relationship with where the components of the cells are and how the virus is interacting with that host cell or in that host tissue. It's a pretty expensive piece of kit. It's about $500,000 of microscope. And the reason why we've got this big Perspex box here is because we can put the living virus-infected cells. So we take the samples out of the incubator. We are able to go inside this box. And inside this box, the atmosphere is humidified and it's got carbon dioxide. So it feels very like what the cells just came out of. They're really happy. They can sit on this little stand, and the microscope over many, many hours can take image after image after image. So instead of looking at viruses in just one dimension or two dimensions or three dimensions, because we can bring time into the mix, we can do four-dimensional virology.
So let's say you're looking at maybe a SARS infection, then you could see maybe where the virus is migrating within a cell, that sort of thing.
And you can see how the virus spreads from cell to cell to cell. And just imagine if you've got a novel therapeutic that you want to test, and you can track the virus in living cells, and you've got the therapeutic, you mix the two together, and then whenever you look down the microscope and the virus is moving a little bit slower, or maybe not moving at all, you know that you've created something which might be an antiviral.
So that's what this place is about, then, better understanding the viruses and maybe finding treatments for them.
Absolutely. You know, ultimately, we don't do science just for the sake of science. We talked about vaccines already. Think about what those amazing biopharmaceuticals have done for human health. And the people who led the way in creating those in the 60s and 70s, we want to be the next generation of scientists who push that further and further and make new therapeutics and understand the viruses and the bacteria at a very, very basic level, but always with a view to helping human and animal health.
Leaving the BSL-3 lab, we walked over to the part of the needle that I was most interested to see. The Maximum Containment Biosafety Level 4 laboratories. To get there, you have to ride in a giant stainless steel freight elevator that appeared to me to be the size of a small family car. And then you have to go through a very sturdy looking set of double doors. Instantly upon entry, we fell foul of the needle's security features.
The Iris scanner knows that one set of eyes were allowed access to this floor, but it saw, using this beam between these two recorders, two sets of legs. So your legs and my legs, one set of eyes, that doesn't make sense, and you see the cameras? That allows us to keep track of an unauthorized entry into this facility. So the building is very intelligent, for want of a better term.
We then found ourselves in a very long corridor, and the next thing we saw was possibly, to me, the most ingenious safety device of the whole tour. It was a ping pong ball in a tube.
You know that a ping pong ball is pretty light. This little ping pong ball here, in this tube, because the pressure in this corridor is lower than the pressure outside, is being sucked to the end of this tube. So this is the simple way. Whenever I walk into this corridor, I just cast my eye, I look at the bright pink ping pong ball, and I know that the building is doing what it should be doing.
Walking through these corridors felt a lot like a modern hospital. Magnolia walls, lino floors, and everything seemed very clean and very sterile. I mean, I'm not really sure what I was expecting. Perhaps I've watched the 1970s movie The Andromeda Strain once too many times. But for all the effort it took to get down here, at this point, the building looked fairly unremarkable, which perhaps belies the pathogens that will be worked on when it's open. Moving through the corridors, though, we eventually got to the labs themselves. As Ron explained earlier, the BSL-4 lab is really a building within a building. And it doesn't really look like that to the untrained eye, but eventually you have to cross the threshold to get inside.
You and I, even though I can shake your hand, are in completely different buildings. This building that I'm standing beside here has to maintain pressure if there is an earthquake. And this building can move completely independently of the building that you're in and still maintain the pressure with inside the facility. It's all about controlling the air that is in this building. So this is the lowest pressure bit of the building. And that makes complete sense, because these are the viruses that you want to contain at the highest containment level. So lowest pressure.
Because these pathogens are so dangerous, to work with them, you have to put on a completely enclosing, full-length protective suit. This has a lot of different layers and components, all of which are designed to keep the researchers and the pathogens separate. Which, when you think about it, is pretty amazing. These microbes, you know, the viruses in particular, are almost unimaginably small. And yet, with modern technology, scientists can turn up for work, handle some of the most dangerous diseases we know of, and still be home in time for tea.
So these are the medical scrubs. So basically we have a top, we have the bottoms of the scrubs, we have lots of towels, these very, very horrible white socks.
Like you'd have on your PE kit back in the day.
Exactly. And the reason why they're so floppy is because they've been autoclaved quite a number of times. And finally we have to take the gloves that we use and we like to use. So we bring all of that stuff and we go in the direction of the suit room.
One final question then. So there is a lot of towels here, which have obviously been boiled washed within an inch of their life. That suggests to me that within the suit is going to get pretty hot.
Yes. But the air that you breathe is very, very dry. So even though you are quite humid, because you're producing a lot of condensation. The air constantly dries you. So this is one of the biggest issues. You get very, very dehydrated in the suit if you're in it for a long period of time.
Well, let's go and have a look at those suits right now then. Okay. Now, getting into these suits is not easy.
Okay, so now, so whenever I come, the first thing I have to do is I have to enter my change room. This is the guy's side. This is the lady's side. I use my card. So this is my locker. I have my scrubs. I have my very horrible white socks. I have my gloves. And I completely remove all of my clothes.
Okay, so for the record, Paul is not stripping down, which I must say I'm quite pleased about. So this is one person at a time in here then?
There will be two people at a time.
God, it's a bit snug, isn't it?
Well, there actually could be more than two people at a time, but I guess that whenever you're used to doing this stuff, it's at that stage of your life, you get to know the people who you work with pretty closely, and I guess that this is the same for here.
After putting on your scrubs, you head through the shower. But you don't shower on the way in because, you know, of course, you're fully dressed. You only shower on the way out. But before you put the rest of the suit on, you have to collect your communications device.
My box with my earbuds and my communication device. And then this communication device goes around my neck. And this is how I talk whenever I'm wearing the suit with my colleague who I'm going in with.
So what Paul's describing here is, I guess, what looks like an old school MP3 player, one of those little ones that, you know, the kind of off-brand ones you might get in an electrical shop. Once you get in the suit, it must be pretty difficult to hear.
Yes, and because it's so noisy, we have to be able to communicate with each other. It's very difficult to speak, so we use these. So whenever I press this button...
Good morning. Please say or spell your first and last name.
Paul Dupre.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Paul Dupre.
So maybe it has a little bit of trouble with the Northern Irish accent?
Well, it has a lot of trouble with a lot of different accents. Right, so this is the most interesting room.
This is the room where the protective suits are kept. And I have to be honest, they are pretty awesome. They look like giant blue spacesuits hanging up on pegs around the wall.
What we have to do first is grab these gloves. So we put these gloves on under the scrubs, and then we take this yellow tape here, which is what you can see, and we stick the gloves to the scrubs.
So that forms a very tight seal then between the gloves and your skin.
It's just to stop the gloves falling off. We also do the same thing and stick the socks to the scrubs. Then we have to go and take the suits. This is my suit, so you see PD. It's a suit which is
It's a big old thing.
Heavy.
My goodness, yeah. Looks like a spacesuit, I guess. It's got lots of holes for valves and stuff. You've got orange gloves at the end. It's a very, very thick, if you can hear that, guys, a very thick kind of, I don't know, plastic vinyl kind of thing. It's got a clear cylindrical headpiece. I guess it's where Paul's head goes. And yeah, I mean, all right. And so just for our listeners, if you just put your head in there and let me talk to you, ask you questions to see how easy it is to hear through it.
So it's completely quiet. I'm not completely contained in it, but you can hear now it's quite hard. For me, because there's this big piece of plastic between me and you.
Yeah. So remember, if I take this back off my head and I take one of the air hoses...
The suits, of course, need to be connected to a clean air supply, and that came from these kind of spirally red hoses that curled down from the ceiling.
And the end of the suit, this is a HEPA filter. So the air which comes down the tube into the suit goes through this HEPA filter to make sure that I get clean air in the suit. And now this is just like plugging in a car tire. So whenever I do this,
okay. The
air from this comes in here, goes through the suit. And what you're getting to hear is the air that comes through the HEPA filter into these tubes, and then it blows into the suit. So if you put your hand inside this is pressurizing the suit, so that the rooms are under negative pressure and the suit is under positive pressure.
So stuff comes out, it doesn't come in.
Absolutely. Everything about me inside that facility is I'm at a much, much higher pressure than the air around me, and that moves any pathogen away from me and into all of the filters which are up in the space above us.
It must be so loud, though. I mean, we can hear it there on the microphone. If it's like, is it that hissing all the time?
Yeah. So this is what the issue is. This is why you wear the earbuds. This is why you have the communications device. Because you can imagine, even if we were going to just talk without that, it's pretty hard to hear whenever I put that on, even without the air. So it's, yeah, it's a pretty noisy environment.
Do you get to listen to tunes at the same time?
Absolutely not. The one thing that that thing doesn't does, it might look like an MP3 player. It does not play any music. It just has a very bad accent and a very difficult to understand voice recognition software.
Once you're suited and booted, the only thing left to do is to step into a final airlock and then into the lab itself.
Okay, so you've checked the integrity of the suit. You've inflated the suit to make sure there aren't any small holes in it. Everything is meticulously checked. And now you're ready to go in.
All right, so listeners, I am standing in front of a massive door. I mean, it's, again, taller than me. It's got like a porthole in it. It's a stainless steel looking thing. It's got like a traffic light on it. And the light has gone from red to amber to green. And the door has just popped open.
But the door not only is stainless steel, but also inflates. So you see this gasket around the outside of it. Whenever the door touches the little valve here, the air is forced into the door and that makes a complete seal. So by pressing this button, the deflated the door, the gasket opened, and that allows you to see for the first time the chemical shower.
Okay, so this is a bit bigger than the last shower. It's enough for two people in here, easy three probably. First thing that hits me, very, very strong kind of disinfectant smell, I would say. You can hear it's quite echoey as well. In fact, there's a big tray of disinfectant on the floor and what looks like a scrubbing brush.
So what you're seeing on the floor and what you're smelling is the tray of Microchem. So this is a quaternary ammonium detergent. And this is what cleans us on the way out.
So basically, like the first personal shower, you don't get washed on the way in. But on the way out, when you've been working with these dangerous pathogens, the chemical shower is designed to clean your suit from head to toe. So there's an impressive array of pipes and a lot of, like tiny little shower heads, I suppose you'd describe them as. So I guess the whole room then is just washed down with, what, disinfectant and water?
So just imagine that we've gone in, we've done whatever we need to do, we've simulated, we've trained, we've come back into this, we've closed this door. This pocket of air contains the same air as the lab. We have to disinfect it. So yeah, all these little holes turn this room into a car wash. Just imagine being in the fog. And that's what this turns into. 3 minutes of chemicals, that chemical that we were talking about, this Microchem, and then 4 minutes of water to rinse off the suit. And the scrubbing brush is for the bottom of your feet, and they train you to stand like this.
So Paul's like standing this, in a kind of a star shape.
Make sure that every bit of the suit is
spinning around like a ballerina.
Basically, that's what it is. It's like a dance in here. And that is to ensure that every single bit of the suit is covered with the Microchem. So now we're coming back out. And what you get to see here is the intelligence of the building.
So listeners then, so you've got a TV screen with a floor plan of this entire kind of facility, I guess. And yeah, everything is a different shade of blue depending on where the pressure is. So I think it's a really smart way of making sure that things don't go where they're not supposed to be.
And remember, we saw lots of different ways to look at pressure because we can't feel the pressure, but we can see it with dials, or we can see it with numbers, or we can see it with a ping pong ball, or this is the high-tech version of the ping pong ball, right? It's exactly the same thing.
Paul, thank you so much for our trip today. It's been super enlightening. Nice one.
Yeah, it's very good to talk to you, and it's very good to show you around the place. It certainly is an impressive facility, and it's nice to just show it off a little bit.
So that was the end of my tour. As you've just heard, there are a huge number of steps that need to be taken before researchers can even get access to the lab, and they undertake incredibly stringent training before they're authorised to do so. But the question that I guess everyone would ask in this situation is, what happens if something does go wrong? That's where Dr. Naheed Badalia comes in. And what's your role here then at the needle?
Each of the biosafety level 4 laboratories around the country have a backup medical program. I run the backup medical program for the needle. So we look at everything from when we hire people, what kind of immunizations do they need to work safely? Are they healthy enough to work safely? All the way to, God forbid, the unlikely event of if something goes wrong. If there's an exposure that was unplanned, we plan all the protocols in terms of isolating, quarantining, and treating patients with pathogens that we're working on here.
So let's work that through then. So I know that, for example, in the safety level 2, you work on things like measles and mumps and rubella, things like that. So that's something that most people are vaccinated for when they're at school, I suppose, or when they're very, very small. Okay. What other sort of things do people need to be protected against in the first instance?
Sure. It's both protected against, but also doing routine surveillance for. So, for example, influenza. We make sure that people get their seasonal influenza vaccine. They may not even be working with that influenza strain here. Tuberculosis, if they're working for with TB, we make sure that we test them for tuberculosis with the skin test or the blood test every 6 months or a year, depending on what their risk levels is. So it's that kind of surveillance to ensure that we're keeping on top of a potential, the health of the lab workers here, I should say.
Which I guess is paramount.
It is. It is for not just the lab workers, but also their colleagues who work with them and for the community at large.
Well, let's follow that through then to its natural conclusion. So let's say I've come to work here, I've been vaccinated, I haven't had flu, I haven't got TB, I hope. And I'm working downstairs in one of the level 4 labs on something, I don't know, let's say Ebola or Lassa fever, something like that. And maybe I stuck myself with a needle. How do you click into gear? What happens to me then?
Sure. I think prevention of something like that starts from the very beginning. We ensure that laboratory workers who work with those kind of pathogens have the right type of training. We also ensure that they are under constant monitoring. They are in there with a buddy, so if something bad happens, you know, they can get care immediately. But we also have set up a very intricate medical backup program to ensure that that person, even if there is a low level of risk of an exposure, is placed into quarantine, is placed into the right sort of medical care. The thing that a lot of people, when they work it through, they realize is that an exposure to an infectious disease is not the same as an infection with that pathogen. There's an incubation period. So for Ebola, for example, that incubation period can be up to 2 days. That's the shortest time. So someone who may be exposed to Ebola is not immediately contagious. So you have this space within which to figure out what the incident was and to actually to transport that patient to what we have here, which is a special pathogens unit. And that's not so much to treat them, but because, particularly with Ebola, we have access to medical countermeasures that might actually keep them from developing that infection. That's the reason that we admit those patients to the medical unit. What that preparation requires is training of the staff to report something when it happens, recognizing the importance of an event like that, training of the first responders within this building, but also first responders at the city level, as well as at the hospital. And it requires training and drilling of the medical staff over there, but also the drilling of all the components coming together in this event. So for example, what we do is we biannually do a drill where we do exactly this. We have someone, you know, act through a potential exposure, and we evacuate them from the biosafety level 4 lab, and we take them to the medical unit at the Boston Medical Side. So everybody knows what their role is. Everybody knows what the next steps are.
So everyone just clicks into gear, I suppose.
Yep, and the goal is to get it to a point where it becomes second nature, where if something like that happens in the unlikely event, there's a lot of anxiety, you know, and the thought is that if you can make it an automatic response, you decrease any chances of mistakes.
what if I had a heart attack, my goodness, or something like that? I mean, I'm a fairly young, fit guy, I'd like to think, but, you know, accidents do happen, or things that you don't expect happen. Right. What would you do there?
So this would be surprising for you to hear, but similar to what the safeguards are in place for pilots, for example, are those, that kind of philosophy is what we employ here in biosafety level 4 laboratories as well. If you are not healthy enough to be in that unit, you don't go into that unit. So some of the medical safeguards that we have in place, for example, is if you have more than a 15% chance of a cardiac event on an annual level, you cannot work in the biosafety level 4 lab. If you mechanically cannot operate or go in and out of the suits, then you're not going to work in a biosafety level 4 lab. And that's for the safeguards for the laboratory worker themselves, but also for everybody else in the program.
So it's almost like, I think if you're over 6 foot, you can't be an astronaut.
You can't take that ride, yep. So one of the other things that we do is we train. So as I mentioned, everybody that's in the biosafety level 4 lab goes in with a buddy. They also carry a what we call Voicera. It's an ability to sort of do instant communication with the outside folks within the lab. And so if an event happens, the buddy is able to activate the Voicera, call in for help, and we train the buddy to be able to evacuate the person who has collapsed out of the biosafety level 4 suite. So even if it wasn't a heart attack, you know, even with a young guy with no cardiac history, you might have a cardiac arrhythmia, you might have a seizure, you might collapse because you're dehydrated. So we sort of play all those into the system, and we ensure that our lab workers always keep ahead of their health.
So what struck me writing about emerging diseases for the Microbiology Society's blog is that there's so many new ones, or so many ones that have already existed for a long time, but because of globalization, deforestation, whatever it is, that we are now coming into contact with them. And does that make the mission of Needle and maybe your department in the hospital quite difficult, because you will be dealing with new things that you have never seen before?
Yeah, that does seem to be the new norm. Every year or year and a half, we are discovering new pathogens or rediscovering pathogens that we had known that are moving into new geographical areas, or pathogens that we thought we had under control, but we no longer have treatment for them. So multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, as you mentioned, but also just gram-negative bacteria, the kind of bacteria that cause routine infections, are becoming harder and harder to treat because of antibiotic resistance. So it's actually not just the special pathogens unit. That's actually a challenge for all hospitals across the board. The role of the Needle will be to help develop the diagnostics and therapeutics to be able to get ahead of that problem. And I think that's the value of a place like this. The other value of the Needle is that it is one of two biosafety level 4 laboratories within the U.S., within the academic space, that allows for a lot of space for partnership with lower and middle income countries, universities. It allows for a lot of collaboration with research and a lot of space for doing innovative work that can help approach a lot of the problems that we've been talking about.
We've only wiped out two diseases, smallpox and rinderpest, and that was via vaccination. So, I mean, maybe we'll get to polio in the next few years. I saw Bill Gates speak last year, or this year, in fact, and he said he was hoping next year would be the year. But again, vaccinations is the key. It's not antibiotics or antivirals. That's treatment rather than prevention. Is that something that this place can make an important difference to?
Yeah, the big goal for the Needle is actually, even stepping one step back, to create the best vaccines. We actually need to know how pathogens work. As you may have heard Ron Corley, the director of the Needle, say, Needle's strength is deep diving into pathogenesis. What we say is the workings of how a disease is caused by infectious pathogens. Once you have that data, once you're armed with that information, you know where to strike those pathogens. And the next step would be the vaccines. But even beyond that, you know, to give somebody a vaccine, you first need to know that they're at risk. Or if it's a vaccine that prevents an exposure into becoming an infection, you need to be able to diagnose them. So the Needle is also working on novel diagnostics, ensuring that we pick up diseases, because if you're not diagnosed, you don't get counted. And if you don't get counted, you know, we don't know how big the problem is.
All right, so you've been here now, you say, for 5 years. Mm-hmm. What's the legacy you're hoping to leave when you do move on to the next job?
One of the missions of the Needle, aside from the things we've talked about, is actually helping our partners improve capacity in low and middle income countries, providing the training for safe research in other spaces. And Needle has actually worked with a lot of other countries that are moving towards building better capacity. So we're hoping to add to that, but also to add to training of staff. We are working with Liberia and Nigeria to set up a training program to improve biomedical sciences research around emerging pathogens. If you have people who have those skills in place, you can quickly pick up those diseases when they arise. And Nigeria has already shown the advantage of something like that.
As Naheed says, the thing about emerging infectious diseases is that so much about them is new and unknown. While large-scale outbreaks are rare, there's always the chance that an obscure virus could come out of nowhere and become a global threat. Think about Zika. Up until last year, very few people had heard of it, but now it's spread across the globe, and in its wake has left a trail of serious healthcare problems. In some ways, we live in an age that's kind of a paradox. On one hand, we know so much about disease transmission and have access to more advanced equipment and knowledge than ever before, so we should be best prepared to tackle any pandemics. But on the other hand, we're really not doing ourselves any favours. There are so many places that still lack basic public healthcare infrastructure, and as the world becomes more connected and globalised, and as we encroach even more into animal habitats, new diseases will jump from animals to humans and have the potential to quickly spread across the globe. This is why I think that labs like the Needle are really important. If we want to be able to prevent future disease outbreaks, we have to understand what's causing them. Well, that's it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about the Microbiology Society, you can find us on our website, microbiologysociety.org. We're on Twitter as well, at microbiosoc, and you can find us on Facebook too. Our show was edited and produced by Anand Jagatia. I've been Dr. Benjamin Thompson. See you next time.